You are now listening to The Scheist Podcast, when millions of opinions just aren't enough.
Hello there, and welcome back to The Scheist Podcast. If you're tuning into this, you may have listened to the first half of this episode, which I guess technically was last week at the movies, but this is this week at the movies, also talking about the last week at the movies, which would have been for the release weekend of January 17th. We got a few films on deck, as this time we're picking up where we left off, talking about Baby Girl, Nickel Boys, The Damned, Den of Thieves 2, Pantera, and a few additional thoughts on my second viewing of Nosferatu. Plus, taking a quick look, or a quick peek at what's on deck for release for the weekend of the 17th, which was Wolfman, One of Them Days, and I'm Still Here. Those were the headlines. This is This Week at the Movies for the weekend of January 17th, 2025. I can hear you eating cheese. It's fine.
Nuh-uh.
Well, I'm going to be probably munching a little bit too, so don't get distracted by the sounds of manja manja. But we're back for the second half of This Week at the Movies, which is last week, technically, kind of. We're finishing off a few stragglers from last week. Baby Girl, Nickel Boys, my rematch with Nosferatu, The Damned, and Den of Thieves 2. So, I guess the first one was Baby Girl, which we saw later in the week and didn't get to it last week. We're just talking about this a little bit in the car, too, on the way home, after seeing Hard Truths, which we'll talk about on Friday or Saturday when we do the show as usual. But, Baby Girl is good. I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. You know, I enjoyed it, and Nicole's good in it. I don't know what else. I mean, it has, like, a very particular sexual energy to it, of course, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but it is very, I think, sort of narrowly focused on that.
Definitely. I mean, I love Nicole Kidman, so I don't think there's anything she's done I haven't liked. And she is great, as always. I think for me, like, I saw too much of the hype around this movie, I think, for me. So I wasn't necessarily going in with set expectations, but I do feel like the sexualization that I saw from people and just, like, in general, I think was a little over dramatic. Like, I saw videos of people, like, you know, they were probably joking, but, like, insinuating they're walking out of the theater and they can't walk, kind of a thing. And I didn't feel that way at all. It felt very predatory to me, and so I feel like I had a hard time capturing the arousal that they're wanting out of this, I think. But that may have just been me.
They couldn't walk out of the theater from all the masturbating they were doing in the theater.
Yep. That was the insinuation.
I mean, people got thrown out of the theater last year for some people, masturbators.
In what movie?
I don't know. Some Sidney Sweeney movie.
What? I didn't remember hearing about
that. And then I think it might have been Love Lies Bleeding, but there was another picture of a guy who, like, fell asleep with his dick out.
Ew.
But he also, the person behind him took a picture, and it was like, there's, like, a box of cigarettes, a bottle of Hennessy on his, like, table, because I guess it was even a nicer theater. And he, like, took his dick out and started jacking off and then passed out and just fell asleep with it out. I had to break this unfortunate news to other film friends of mine. They were like, what are you talking about? I was like, oh, sorry, I'm going to have to be the one to let you know.
That's something that happened here in LA, you mean?
I think one of them was here, maybe. I don't remember.
That's disturbing.
Yeah.
In a public setting.
Fucking shadow jaggers.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not that kind of theater.
No. I get that existed, but... yeah. So, I mean, again, like, I didn't dislike the movie. I did like it. I think she was great. Would I sit through it again? Probably not. Would I tell everyone to rush out and see it? Probably not. But I would say it's definitely worth watching, depending on the person and their taste. It's not a movie for everyone, for sure. But yeah, it just felt very predatory to me from the get-go. And on... what's his character's name? On his part, not necessarily on her part to start.
Harris Dickinson's character.
Yeah, Harris Dickinson's character. So I wasn't feeling the arousal component. I think the way it was shot, though, especially like, you know, the underwater scene and stuff, was phenomenal. They did a good job with it. And more power to, you know, Nicole Kidman for putting herself out there like that. I, you know... applaud her for it, and I'm sure she'll get recognized for it. She probably won't win, but she'll get recognized for it, like she did at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, I mean, she is Nicole Kidman, and she is good in the movie, and it feels like an erotic thriller of the basic instinct fatal attraction type, mm-hmm. with being a little bit more focused on the psychology of the relationship as opposed to like the psychopathy of the relationship. And it does feel oddly predatory at times, but also that could be a primer from other things. So you have him being like, he's not in a position of power over her in any actual way. Other than he's like just a man, but it's like, yeah, he's like 20 something. He's an intern. He sort of is very aggressive, sort of like quietly aggressive in his pursuits of like getting close to her and injecting himself into her personal space. But at the end of the day, you know, there is a conversation in the movie where he's like, no, you don't understand, like, this is about consent, and like, he's very considerate of the fact that this is like sort of this quiet contract that they've entered into together to engage in this behavior. And I don't think that idea is to like feel that Nicole's character is victimized by this, right? We start with her faking an orgasm and then going in the other room and rubbing one out on the floor while watching porn, and then trying to express her sexual appetite to her husband, who's like, that's weird, I can't get down with that. And then that kind of just like stops it. Like, had he entertained it, they may have been able to open up a conversation about what she needs and what he's not providing, and maybe the whole torrid affair with the kid never happens. But it's about, I think, the sexual repression more than it is anything else. So
yeah, I agree, but I also do think there is a power play on his part very quickly, because he's like, I can destroy you with this. So that right there is the manipulation and power play, even though he's not in a position of power, quote unquote, as like her boss in the workplace. But he very quickly uses that. And as soon as she engages, he's got the power, because he's like, I can bring you down with this. So yes, I understand what you're saying. It goes to the consent as far as like the rough play, maybe, but she's still kind of manipulated into this while then manipulating him too at the same time at some point potentially. But I don't feel like it's true manipulation necessarily, because she's, you know, like you said, she tried to have this conversation with her husband, and this kid is willing to engage, and then they have the consent conversation, or do we need a safe word, right? So he's responsible about it, but he does exert that power essentially fairly quickly.
He also doesn't exactly know what he's doing. Like, she's attracted to him because he like got the attention of a dog on the street, right? That he whistled and the dog listened. And there, you know, I've heard that before, is that like man who has control over like a large dog, like in a dominant fashion, is an attractive thing. Like, I don't know. I don't have control over our dog. So, so who knows? But their entire relationship, I mean, yeah, it is a relationship and it is this affair. And I think they're both in territory they don't know. Like, he knows that he's attracted to her and that she's interested in him for some reason. And so he starts like pulling at that thread, and then he finds out what it is. And so when it begins to get away from him, that's when he's like, I could destroy your whole career. He sort of like snaps back at her with the like, no, you have 7 minutes, and the power dynamic shifts. And then he sort of pulls back from that. He's like, but like, this is what you want. You want to do this, right? And then she has to acknowledge that, like, yes. So I mean, obviously this is about like sort of a taboo subject, in that she's having an affair. Like, her husband is presented for all intents and purposes to be a good guy. And interesting, you choose Antonio Banderas to be like the husband who can't give a woman an orgasm, when he's been, you know, Antonio Banderas, the sex symbol for a large part of his career.
Because it has nothing to do with looks. You got to have skill.
Yeah. And so maybe this version of him just doesn't have the skill in the bedroom, or she's just not, they're just not going to the place that she needs to go to. And I think that's really sort of what the movie is talking about. And there is a lot of maybe fetishes and sexual appetites that would be considered unsavory or messy. But the whole point of having like a partner that you actually trust is to be able to go to those places safely and not have to worry about like the actual danger. It's like when the same sort of muscle you're flexing when you watch like a horror movie, like you're allowing yourself to feel fear in a safe space. And it's like, that's the thrill of it. Is so I think that's kind of what the movie is getting at. And I'm not, you know, a sex therapist or an expert on that by any means. I might be by the time I'm done with that other show, but it's an interesting movie. I think it's worth checking out, especially if you're just a fan of like performances and you want to see Nicole in this role. And if you're a fan of stuff like Secretary or other like sort of BDSM dominant submissive stories, which are interesting. I mean, I really liked Dogs Don't Wear Pants, which is the story of this guy dealing with grief and like just wanting to be horribly abused and like basically killed every night. And then right at the moment he's going to die, he breathes, and him developing an erotic sort of friendly, love-like relationship with his dominatrix. And so I think this is maybe more of a above-ground version of that, where the leather-clad nipple clamps and whips and stuff is more the underground version, where literally in that movie he's going to like an underground sex chamber. And in this is done in like a high-rise in New York City kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a lot to say, too, because, you know, there's so much shame around women wanting to enjoy sex, yes, or just exactly pleasure in general, and especially of a certain age, you know. So I think this is an important perspective or just topic in general to elevate. In other ways, too.
Yeah, I got to tell Constance about this movie.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, especially like the other extreme, like you're talking about the other movie, that, of course, you know, people have their fetishes and that's fine. But this is from, I feel like this is a more personal level of that theme when it comes to women's sexuality, and not just women in their 50s, 60s and plus.
Yeah.
But like women in general, and kind of to speak to the Antonio Banderas component, like it's kind of cliche to a certain degree, but it comes from something, right? Where men are usually much more in tune with their own pleasure and not their partners. Excuse me.
Most men.
That's what I said. And not all men.
A lot of men.
A lot of men. It's kind of the norm. And it doesn't really matter what age they are, because Antonio, like he says, or like she says, it's been 19 years. So they were...
Zero orgasms.
That breaks my heart for Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, me too.
And all women in those situations. But that goes to speak to the Antonio Banderas comment too, as far as like, you know, he's... You know, he's not my type, but he's good looking to a lot of people. He's got charisma and personality, but that only takes you so far. And if that was a 19 year issue, that means they were probably in their 20s or 30s and he still wasn't doing it. So it's not like it's nice to see like age really has nothing to do with what's going on here.
Yeah. And this is a movie that was written and directed by a woman. So not really super surprising to see that this is how the story is told. And I think that's probably the biggest difference between this and
absolutely
some other kind of similar story is that.
Or all other.
Well, this is focused on like not just the taboo of having an affair and having an affair of this ilk. It's really about the taboo or like the unspoken rule of like not being able to talk about sexual appetite as a woman without being a slut or a whore, you know, like she can't just be horny and be normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly the shame around that that comes with that, too. Right. Like if it was if the roles were reversed and it was a man in the position, it would be glorified in a different way versus frowned upon. And I said to you that one of the first things I said to you after we saw this was it had to be written by a woman. And it was very, very obvious. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad.
A 6.5 on IMDb and an 80 Metascore. So I think in a nutshell, that's sort of like audiences are maybe a little bit less adept to it because of like we need less sex in movies and TV and stuff. You don't want to see sex in stories anymore, but it's probably people that aren't having sex don't want to be reminded of the thing that they're not having, you know, but
true.
I think there's like a certain type of egregious sex that like you don't have to have in a movie. And I don't think this movie has that, to be honest.
Yeah.
So this isn't one of those where I think you need to worry. But if you're like very prude and you're like, ooh, she's masturbating, like, can't believe I saw that and don't need that in a story. It's like.
Skip it.
Yeah, it's human. And I think casting Nicole Kidman, like we talked about like what her age range is supposed to be in this movie. And I was like, my general takeaway is that it's like she's 50 plus, right? I think she's like in her early 60s in real life. So I don't think the character necessarily is that old because of the age of their children in the story. But I think it also like doesn't matter. The point is that she's sort of like an older woman in a position of power, like hierarchy wise, business wise, and she's dealing with a younger man. And that's kind of it. You don't need to know her exact age in this story to make it impactful, you know. But yeah, I'd say watch it.
Sure.
I don't think if it were up to me, if it were my Academy ballot, I wouldn't cast it for her. I don't even know if the nominations came out. They were supposed to yesterday, but there was 10 for the Globes because they do both categories for musical, comedy, and drama. But we'll see. She's good. I love Nicole Kidman. We did see her AMC ad before the movie, so they weren't like blackballing that, you know, trying to change anybody's mind.
They shouldn't.
I want to see a version of the AMC trailer where she's watching herself on screen and then smiling and like, here they are, magic. But we'll move on because we also saw Nickel Boys, which is directed by Ramel Ross and written by Ramel Ross, Jocelyn Barnes, and Colson Whitehead, I think, was the author of the book. So this is an adaptation. And an interesting adaptation in that it's almost like an experimental art film, like telling it from first person perspective, changing the first person perspective often in the movie. Also then just randomly inserting sort of like static shots of where this couldn't possibly be first person perspective. And then using all of that to tell this story of this like basically prison camp in the South, like Nickel Academy. Like, it's not an academy. This is a juvenile detention center, is by what it looks like, at least. And It's good. It's slow, but it's an interesting film. I respect what the film is like wanting to achieve here. I don't know that it needs to be as long as it does, but it is sort of like a weird ethereal experience. Almost like, I think narrative wise, we get to a point where we see a lot of like non-linear sequencing where it's like, oh, it's this person's a kid. Now they're maybe young adult or teenager. Now they're an adult adult. Now they're you see like 50s and 60s. So it's like you're jumping through, I think, probably like the 60s, the 70s, the 90s, and then current. But they don't really like explain that out loud. You just kind of have to see it. There's not even like a title card on screen to let you know that the time is changing. You just have to kind of pay attention. So I think in that way, the movie is almost presented as if it's someone looking back through their memory, or like we're looking back through a memory. And as weird as it sounds, I think the movie that popped into my head was Zone of Interest, because that movie sort of is an observation of a time in history where there's a lot of sort of just like passivity around something really horrible. And that's kind of how this operates, in that by seeing it through the first person's character eyes, like you get a lot of the texture and the experience of just like existing in this world and in this time period and in this place. But meanwhile, like there's something really nefarious happening there. And that's sort of at the end of the story arc, we find out what is going on and why the timeline is moving all the way to the future. And we figure out, you know, once all the pieces are in place. So in that way, it's sort of like, yeah, Zone of Interest and Moonlight sort of mixed together stylistically. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. But it was a little confusing to switch who the first person perspective belonged to a couple times. But when you get to the end of the story, I think it makes sense as to why that happens. Like while it's happening, I'm like, okay, so not first person. And then it's like, no, wait, it is first person. It's just a different first person. And so I don't want to like ruin that part of it for people who haven't seen it, but there is a reason why the perspective is switching like that. And based on a true story, I think I need to look at the actual book by Coulson, but what did you think of it sort of in broad strokes?
I mostly agree. I think that it was definitely long and a little slow. I struggle when they bounce around like that personally without it being more obvious. So I do kind of get a little bit lost. And not to say that that's a bad thing, because I, like you said, I understand the storytelling perspective for a reason towards the end, or like when it comes together, but it does kind of lose me. So I feel like with these kind of movies, I need to watch it again, because then I feel like I won't get lost, essentially.
That's fair. And I was a little bit right and a little bit wrong in that, yes, Colson Whitehead wrote the book. The book is a novel, but it's a novelization about a real place.
Okay.
So
like names and schools and characters are changed.
Well, the book is about the Dozier School, which was a reform school in Florida that operated for 111 years and then was revealed to be highly abusive.
Shocker.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if like there's truth to this story, but I have not investigated how true it is. So don't hold me to that. But I think the interesting thing is that, like, I was trying to find a way to contextualize this, but I think in framing it as a first-person story, rather than sort of like you're watching things happen to the character, you're the character. And so you're watching the things happen to you, or you're feeling the things happen to you. And it frames the experience of being Black, I think, especially in the South, differently than other films do it. And I think doing it in that sort of like observational style is maybe differently effective than I've seen in other films. Like, it's just a filmmaking choice. Like, when you're going to sort of dramatize a scene and you're focused on the character's face, you're doing a close-up. Like, if you take all those scenes that are in this movie and you shoot them a different way and you're focused on the character and you're, like, watching his expressions and how they feel, and it's like, this is asking the audience, like, how do you feel experiencing this, versus here we kind of are like showing you how this character feels and you're going to empathize with it or not. So it's a very interesting way to do it that way. And I mean, it's got really good critical reviews. It's got a 91 from Metascore and Metacritic, and wow, got a 7.7 IMDb, so very solid. It's not my favorite movie of the year. It's not the movie I think is the best movie of the year, but I think it rightfully belongs in the conversation for it.
Yeah. And the performances were great.
Yeah, they were. I think it's another thing of, like, when you don't, you're not, like, putting all your eggs in the basket of the cast, right? This is just, we're asking Ethan Hersey and Brandon Wilson to basically carry this. And this is obviously probably a small budget film. Who is it? Ingenue Ellis Taylor is the only name that I recognize probably in the movie. No, Jimmy Fails. I know him. He was in Last Black Man in San Francisco, and it was good to see him again. I wish he had a bigger part, honestly, but other than that, it's a lot of sort of unfamiliar faces. Of Fred Hechinger was, who was in Gladiator 2, and he's in Thelma, and he's been in a lot of stuff. He's had a really strong year, honestly. But not having this be somebody familiar helps this story, because again, it's like, it's just taking another layer of the audience familiarity away from the narrative style and just, like, letting you be there in the moment and sort of, like, living in this place rather than watching it happen. I don't know. It's a little tough to articulate, but I think I've made my point okay.
Yeah. I mean, I like when movies do that with more, like, people who are not A-listers, you know? I think it's important to spread the projects around for people who are not.
Spread those projects. Spread them.
Take this out.
No, I'm not taking that out. But we'll move on to the next movie.
Okay.
Yeah, Nickel Boys, definitely recommend. I think if you're a person like me who wants to see sort of like the movies that are going to be talked about and in consideration at the end of the year, your picture of the year would be incomplete without it. Whether or not you love it and it's your favorite movie of the year, you think it's the best, those are other things. But I think it's important to see this, especially given some of the styles of other movies.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. I'm chewing that salami. They can hear it. And those are the only two that we saw together. And then I went and saw Nosferatu again. Liked it a little bit better, because I just dialed into, like, a little bit differently. Ultimately, still didn't change how I felt from the first time. I was not super sleepy or anything. Like, it was the middle of the day. I was ready to go. And then I still started getting sleepy during it. And I was like, okay, so it wasn't just Christmas breakfast. A friend wrote a review of it. Steven, actually, who I talked to for our episode on Absurd, on Bad Movies We Love, he articulated his issues with it very well. And I think just look for Stevenage on Letterboxd and you can read that. Or I would do it an injustice. And I don't want to read the whole thing here because I'm not here to, like, kick Nosferatu. Kick him in his fucking swinging, uncircumcised dick dangling on the screen. Nosferatu's got a lot of strengths, right? I think Lily Rose Depp is great. It looks fantastic. Nick Holt is great. I felt less less distracted by the styles of performances. Because the first time I remember when we talked about it, I said it just felt like everybody got different direction on like what kind of movie they're in. And so like I felt like Aaron Taylor Johnson like was tonally not in the same place. And then I watched him this time. I was like, okay, I don't know what it was about the first time, but I liked him a lot better the second time around. I think it's just something about like the voice that he's using. Cause when I hear him talk in every other movie, he never sounds like that. So it was like, he was a little bit like too posh and British, which maybe like struck me weird, but Ralph Ineson is great and takes it seriously. Then you got Willem Dafoe coming in like a fucking psychopath. And, he's, you know, he's doing his thing as Willem Dafoe does. And then Nick Holt is like taking it seriously, but then like kind of over dramatized in some certain situations, like the scene in the where he first meets the Count. Like he's so just like jittery and scared. And I don't know why he would necessarily have reason to be like, it's nighttime, but you wouldn't expect this person to be a vampire. But then he's like kind of hallucinating in that moment, too. So it's like he's going through some shit. But yeah, overall, I think still probably one of the better movies of the year, at least from like a pure craftsmanship point of view. And people love it, so I'm not going to take that away from them. We'll see what happens with Lily Rose Depp, if she makes it to the sort of like the final table for the awards consideration. But I then went and saw the movie The Damned, which is also similarly about a shipwreck that then sort of curses these people that were at the fishing village where the shipwreck happened. But I mean, long story short, there is a small fishing town and they see a wreck out in like a very rocky part of their cove, and they know it's a problem, but there's some other ship there that showed up and they didn't know how to handle that and they crashed. And so the woman who inherited the fishing company from her deceased husband has to make a decision on whether or not to like send resources to go and try to rescue the people from the boat that crashed. And she ultimately decides to do it, but it's nighttime, it's very dangerous. And upon attempting to do this, things go horribly wrong. And so as everybody like comes back to the village, then all of a sudden it's like we're cursed, weird stuff starts happening. And I felt like it was an interesting take on like how guilt haunts you and sort of how it becomes horrifying over time. Like if you can't forgive yourself for things, how just like trapping that becomes and how heavy the weight of that is. So it's interesting. I didn't like love it the way that I had thought I was going to from the trailer, but it's an interesting, good, solid, especially for early in the year, like a intriguing horror movie in terms of like what it makes you think about. I don't know how the ending is going to sit with a lot of people, but I actually liked what it did and sort of made me like the movie more right as it ended. And I was like, okay, all right, good stuff. I'm going to have to think on this one a little bit more, but carrying a 6.2 on IMDb and a 64 Metascore, so kind of right in the realm where I would think, where it's mostly good, but is not overwhelmingly liked or highly scored. So there's that. And then the last one from that was on the docket from last week was Den of Thieves 2 Pantera. And I saw Den of Thieves 1 back in 2018 when we had MoviePass. And so that was a MoviePass movie for me. And it was just like a good, fun, kind of like violent, R-rated crime thriller. And this one is similar, but I like that it changed. I would say the first one is probably more like something like Heat, where it's like gang and cops on a collision course, guns, violence. There's dirty cops, you know, you're sort of sympathizing with the gang member. So like things have changed, but sort of similar attitude wise. And then the second one, like you could just do that again But I like that this movie sort of became a buddy cop movie. And whether or not that works for everybody is going to... It's going to have to, like, well, remains to be seen. But it has a 6.6 IMDb and a 60 Metascore. So, again, like, good. People have spoken highly of it. You could make a one of these every couple of years, and it would probably be entertaining. Gerard Butler's really good. O'Shea Jackson Jr. is solid in this as well. And they're just really fun together. So, if it wanted to become just an exclusively buddy comedy franchise, I wouldn't dislike it. But I think the reason that I appreciate that is because the sort of instinct is to just make the same movie again and like keep the same trajectory. So having the humor work well throughout this movie makes a big difference, and it makes it feel like it's a different movie. But then when the action and like the violence starts happening, you're sort of back in the same place. And so I appreciate and respect it for that. So nice to see, but
cool beans.
All right. Well, we saw Hard Truths today. We'll circle back on that one for our end of week wrap up this week. And then we'll see what else we can check off the list.
I'm looking forward to movies coming out this Friday.
Yeah. Well, last week. Oh, yeah. We forgot about that. Last week we had Wolfman, One of Them Days. I'm Still Here. So I'm Still Here is probably the one that picked up the Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Drama. Fernanda Torres, I think. And so I still want to see that one.
Yeah.
There's a couple more good ones that I want to check off the list. I need to see Ghostlight. I've heard everybody speak very highly of it, and I still haven't seen that one yet. So we'll see. And then there's some other ones that we can check out at home, and we'll see what else we get to.
All right.
I know. We just got Wolfmanned out by the trailer.
Yeah, especially the updated trailer that shows too much.
Yeah, why are you showing me the Wolfman wolfing? I'm like, that's what the movie is for. I like Christopher Abbott. I like Julia, but...
Yeah. I don't understand why they're still doing that. They showed too much in
trailers. It must have not been tracking well. They're like, hey, we've shown this trailer a lot, and ticket sales are not trending well. There's no online buzz. What do we need to do to generate more buzz? They're like, well, let's show the wolf then.
I guess.
Less is more.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is, even if that didn't happen, the first day it came out, people would have just been posting it on Twitter anyway. So. Yeah. Because those people stink. All right. Cool. I'm going to eat the rest of the salami. I'm going to finish editing this episode.
All right.
And get it out to your ear holes.
Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday. Go see some movies. $5
Tuesday. $7
Tuesday
now.
Yeah. Damn fees. Oh, well. It's still theater day.
It is.
Cool. All right. Be well. Stay safe. Take care, everybody. Go have some fun at the movies. Adios.
Indulging me. Get the movies. Sometimes we see a lot of movies together. Sometimes we don't. Watch a lot of things together. And that's kind of going to be the premise when we dive into our own show. But for now... And you're stuck with us until we figure that out. Everybody who took the time to listen to the episode, and please remember that the opinions expressed on this show are just that. Heard, word of mouth is still the best way to help, so please tell somebody, but liking, subscribing, and sharing the show help too. ...of thescheist.com, and if you'd like to be a guest on the show, or you have something to tell me, you can contact me at info@thescheist.com, or at Scheist Podcast on Twitter. And as usual, be well, stay safe, and have fun no matter how you get your movies.